This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A lot of us are beginning to question our food. Is it safe? Where is it coming from? Many people want to take an active role while preparing for harder times to come as energy spikes and the climate shifts. We look to new voices, and Sharon Astick is someone you'll find both doing and communicating in many forums. She's a New England mother and small-scale grower now teaching food survival skills. Sharon, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with something from your latest book with co-author Aaron Newton called A Nation of Farmers. You picked out the year 2008 as a kind of tipping point for food. Tell us about that.
Well, I think in 2008 was sort of the critical moment when we saw people begin to be really conscious of their food in a way that they hadn't been before. And we saw a number of things happen. First of all, that was the year of the food crisis internationally, and all of us saw on the news what ended up being, more than a billion people are now hungry, the most that have ever been in human history. And it also was a moment where people were transitioning into an awareness of where their food was coming from. And both in bad ways, that's when we had the melamine scandal and we had a botulism scandal with processed food, and in really good ways as more than 2 million people started gardening that year. So it really is a critical moment in our history that we started thinking about our food in ways we hadn't been.
And you've been involved with the peak oil movement for some years now. What kinds of social changes do you see from that coming energy crunch?
One of the things that's changing is I think that more and more people realize that they can't expect to know what it's going to cost them to do things like feed their families or heat their home. And we've certainly seen the ways that energy and food are sort of deeply intertwined. The rise in food prices, the UN estimates that about 60% of that had to do with biofuel usage, which was being ramped up to compensate for high oil prices. And in fact, we're sort of seeing that situation play out again now. And we can expect to see food prices starting to rise as oil prices rise. So one of the things that was really sort of startling, I think, was for people to realize just how tightly linked food and energy prices are and how volatile those prices are and how unstable they are.
And it started, I think, this peak oil movement as kind of an insider guy thing with a lot of technical expertise. And now you say it's a women's issue. Why is that?
Well, quite some time ago, back in 2005, I wrote a piece called Peak Oil is a Women's Issue. And that was precisely because at the time I was one of the few women writing about energy and environmental issues in the same way. And I think the alarm was raised by people who were technical experts, people who were doing petroleum geology, people who were doing alternative energy technologies. And I don't want to minimize the enormous importance of what they did. But once you get past the variations on, peak oil is 2008, peak oil will be 2012, debates, you get down to the fact that peak oil and climate change both represent to us a larger and more basic question that can't be answered by people whose focus is the technologies and the technical details, which is how are we going to live? And that, I think, particularly when we're dealing with things like food and shelter and basic support systems, that is a women's issue. And that's an issue, I think, that resonates really deeply with women.
So I was thinking about talking with you. I also thought about our meat production system. We treat sensitive animals like they're pieces of stone or wood. For example, agri-corporations, they say it's okay to stack pigs in metal cages 3 or 4 feet high with no exercise and fed until they're abnormally fat. And I thought, now that I think about it, isn't that the way we're starting to live ourselves?
I think there's some of that. I think that, in some ways we're abnormally aware of animals. I mean, I think that human history has not always been one of great sensitivity to animals. Certainly we don't bull bait anymore. On the other hand, I also think that we have become sort of hypersensitive about our personal pets while permitting categories of animals and humans to be industrialized in ways that are just inhumane. So we, for example, really get upset when a natural disaster happens and somebody's dogs or cats are left behind, and yet we will raise chickens and pigs and cows in factory conditions. Same, we have the same problems with human beings. There are categories of humans that we're really capable of identifying with in very sort of sensitive and strong ways, and whole categories of human in the world who we really don't identify with, and we're perfectly content to have them ground up in an industrial machine.
I think you've got a good point there, and we're going to all have to search for solutions on that. But moving to another front, you've also suggested that more sustainable farming could help the climate, and I know that's a huge issue. We could write a book just about that, but could you give us a couple of hints on how that might work?
Sure. Somewhere between 20 and 35%, depending on who you ask and how you draw the circle, of all climate gases are related to agriculture. And what we have found is that we really need to deal with these. We need to deal with food systems. And it's not just carbon, it's methane. And one of the major sources of methane, of course, is our feedlot agriculture with animals. And it's also nitrous oxide, which is produced when we use artificial fertilizers on our grains. So we have this enormous difficulty of dealing with this climate project, and it's being horribly expanded by the way we're growing food. However, those natural systems that we rely on to grow our food are also systems that are capable of holding carbon. Our soils contain carbon, our oceans contain carbon, our forests are great carbon sinks. And there's some really interesting information about ways that we could do this. For example, Joel Salatin, who's a somewhat famous farmer, he's wrote the book Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. Well, his pastures, which have been managed without tillage for many, many years, are sequestering as much carbon as a similarly sized forest. And he's raising food off of them. He's raising meat on grass. And the manure that's enriching those soils is allowing him to sequester large quantities of carbon. So one of the things that Aaron and I talk about in the Nation of Farmers is the way that home-scale agriculture can allow us to be part of the solution, because, of course, we have, 30 million acres of lawn in the United States, most of which is contributing to the carbon problem rather than helping.
And that climate crisis is developing so fast. I'm thinking of the floods in Rhode Island and Katrina, and I can see the day coming when bankrupt state and federal governments, and most of them seem to be going bankrupt, they won't be able to provide the disaster aid or even maybe repair the damaged infrastructure. So how could decentralized food or knowing how to grow our own help people get through possibly difficult times?
Well, I think if we look at the history of societies that have suffered sort of a collapse to a lower level of function. That doesn't necessarily mean they've turned into Mad Max, but they've gone from being a more affluent society to a less affluent society, or they've gone from being a more engaged government to one where government's overwhelmed by its own problems. We find that people really do turn to their gardens. In the United States during the Great Depression, in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. In Russia, it was really fascinating. Economists who analyzed the problem looked at the Russian people and said, by all measures, these people should be starving. And they weren't. And nobody could figure out where they were being fed. And they were being fed largely from gardens. They were being fed from small-scale farms and small gardens. And in fact, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia has been bucking the world trend, and its farms are actually getting smaller because people don't trust large farms anymore. They don't trust industrial agriculture. They know that can fall apart. So what they trust are small and local farms. So we have some pretty good evidence that if you look through our history, when sort of distant systems become harder to control, when there's a lot of disruption in our society, that local agriculture can step in and fill the gap. It's not a perfect solution to every problem. There can still be problems at the local level where you can lose local harvests, and that's why you certainly want relationships between cities and countrysides. You certainly want trade to continue. But if you're not dependent for every bite of your food to come from long distances, if you need to trade for fewer items, if you're importing a smaller percentage of your food, you have a level of resilience that we don't have right now.
Well, you raise a good point, too. I mean, surely we don't have the room for everyone to leave the city for the country to achieve an agrarian renaissance. So what is the role for city dwellers now?
Well, and I think that's really important. I think, in fact, one of the things that I say very often is that we most need to grow food exactly where people are. We don't need to grow. We don't need to necessarily move more food production outside of the cities. We need to move more of it in. And what we find, again, if you look at other countries, what we find is that in a lot of the developing world, cities produce somewhere between, somewhere around 25% of two things. Their fresh vegetables and their meats. They produce their meats by making use of all of the food scraps that dense populations have, from restaurants and from households to feed things like pigs and chickens. Instead of buying grain, and which is what we do now, we feed our meat animals on grains, they're actually feeding their animals on food scraps and keeping those food scraps out of landfills and also making sure that there's more calories locally. And the other thing that's being grown in gardens are vegetables. And studies overwhelmingly find that urban and peri-urban agriculture makes a huge difference in nutrition, particularly child nutrition. Children of families that are engaged in urban agriculture, even very, very poor families, tend to have nutritional levels that are equivalent to middle-class families.
I'd like to run something by you about going back to the land. You know, I was part of the Back to Land movement in the late 1970s, and nuclear war seemed possible. New York City and Chrysler both did go bankrupt. I think it was in around 1981. People lost their homes to 20% interest rates. It all sounds kind of familiar now, but things did recover. So I guess my point is, I feel that people should move to a rural setting not because they fear the apocalypse, but because they want a real and healthy lifestyle and maybe they're seeking a more functional community. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that rural life is not for everybody. It has advantages and disadvantages. I've chosen it personally, but not because I don't like cities or think there's a future for them, but because I do like the country and I do like my way of life. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of rhetoric in the peak oil and climate change movement about one kind of model. Oh, well, we all have to live in dense, walkable, new urbanist cities, or, you know, that's it. It's the end of suburbia. That's the end of this, you know. I think that, quite honestly, things are going to be more complicated than that. We're going to have some suburbs that survive and are quite functional, and some suburbs that we let go. We're going to see some cities that can't stay at the sizes that they are now, that are going to decline, in some cities that will probably succeed extremely well. There have been cities of a million people for 2,000 years. We're certainly going to see some countryside areas, I think, become more important as they supply food systems, but some may find themselves isolated without transportation or sufficient water. So I think it's going to be a very complicated movement of, you know, of both people and landscape that we're going to see over the next century, and it's very hard to predict exactly how that's going to play out. So I think people should live where they want to.
Good point. Do you see a change coming in land ownership? I mean, right now it costs a lot of money to buy a property that you can farm, even near a small market. And many younger people are loaded with student loans or credit card debt, or may even be coming out of a period of unemployment. How can people get access or get growing, get some experience in this?
I think that's a really important thing, and I think land access may become one of the central issues of our times in the United States, just as it has been in much of the developing world. I think there are a lot of ways that people can get access to land if they don't have it. I mean, there are some obvious ones, like you can look for community garden plots. If there isn't one in your neighborhood or your community, you should definitely consider starting them. And many urban centers are really into community gardens now because they're a low-cost development project they can do without straining the already strained city budgets. But there are other ways. My co-author, Aaron Newton, started his first CSA farming on a mix of public land and in his neighbor's yards. He contacted older neighbors who were having trouble taking care of their yards. He grows food in their yards and gives them a share for the space and spreads the rest around to his neighbors. Certainly, there are lots of farmers out there who are looking for younger people to apprentice to them because their own children don't want to go into the business, and the average American farmer is 59 years old. So we're going to have to deal with this question of who's going to grow our food, regardless of peak oil and climate change. We have a demographic crisis in agriculture.
Our guest is Sharon Astick, who I'll call one of the new green pioneers. She might not take that label, but I like it. And in 2008, she published the book Depletion and Abundance, Life on the New Homefront from New Society Publishers, and now her latest, A Nation of Farmers. Sharon, can you describe some of the new agrarian experiments that hold some promise?
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. I think my parents were part of the Back to the Land movement in the 1970s, and I think one of the things that sort of was really successful about that movement is that it gave people a sense of, you know, what was possible for to create a new food system. I mean, that's a really big thing. We didn't have an organic agriculture movement. We didn't have this kind of localized food system. And that's really a legacy, I think, of the old Back to the Land movement. What I think is maybe more successful about the modern version is that people aren't necessarily trying to reinvent everything at once. My own sense is that the previous movement was also trying to reinvent social arrangements. So the sort of communal households that were typical in a lot of Back to Land movements often didn't succeed. And one of the things that I'm seeing is a lot of people going back to the land, but with their families, with extended families, with their parents, going back to or buying land together with friends, but people living in separate households rather than in sort of traditional communal models. And I think that's really fascinating. I also really think city farming is one of the most fascinating things. And there's some really amazing experiments going on with what people are growing and raising in urban centers right now. There's an amazing number of agricultural projects out there, including there's a lot of woody agriculture stuff going on. Phil Rutter up at Badgerset Farm is doing some amazing things with chestnuts and with hazels as calorie crops to replace soybeans, which, I mean, these things are really amazing, and there's so many possibilities. We've changed our food system so much in some ways in the last 60 years. It gives us a sense of what's possible when we think about the kinds of changes we have to make in the future.
As you've said, many of the farmers with the most knowledge are growing old. What have you seen out there in the way of skills transfer, of passing on the necessary know-how?
That's a difficult one, and it's difficult for a couple of reasons. We're actually facing, I think, a really strange situation. It's one we've never had in human history, that after this generation of farmers, the majority of American farmers won't have been raised on a farm. It's a very strange thing because that has literally never happened before. The children of farmers were the primary backbone of our agricultural community for all of human history. You learned this stuff at your parents' knees. And what we've seen for decades and decades is the gradual decline in farmers down to the well under 2% that we're seeing now. Well, those numbers are going to have to rise as we shift from less oil in agriculture. And the average farmer is 59 years old, as I said before, so we're going to have to start new farmers. And those people are going to come not out of farm families, because most of those older farmers' children have already left the land. They're going to come from probably two places, and I've been writing about this recently. The first is they're going to come out of gardens. They're going to come out of suburban backyards and schoolyard gardens and inner city gardens, because that's where those young people will have come into contact with food production and agriculture. They're not being raised on farms. They're getting this experience elsewhere. The other place that they're coming from is they're coming from immigrant populations, many of whom are, you know, fairly recently removed from large populations of farmers, and people grew up on farms. And I think that's where the new face of American farming is really shifting, and it's going to be a complicated transition, I think.
And you teach food preservation using online classes. How does that work?
Well, I think a lot of us actually really want to take the next step in dealing with our food system. You know, you grow vegetables and then you think, okay, I've got more of this than I need. What am I going to do next? And that's this question. And everybody sort of remembers their grandma putting up those canned goods, but most of us didn't pay attention and we don't remember how to do these things. So when I first started growing food, the next step for me was learning how to preserve it. And having done that, I started teaching other people and writing about it. And in fact, my latest book actually from last year is Independence Days, which is a guide to sustainable food storage and preservation. And what's been really interesting to me was, you know, I wrote two books. One of them was about peak oil and climate change and the sort of state of our problem. And people used to argue with me a lot when I would do interviews about that one. And one of them was The Nation of Farmers. And, you know, parts of it people really liked. They liked the gardening part. But then when I said, well, we really need a lot more people to be involved in the food system, they'd argue. But whenever I start talking about making jam and putting things in root cellars and preserving, what everybody says is, oh, my grandma did that. I really want to know how to do that. So it's been a really fun project for me to see how excited people are about turning this stuff into food that they can have all year round, that they can save money with, that they can enjoy, and sort of take that next step in eating locally.
I'd like to hear about your own experience in food production. What have you been up to?
Well, we were sort of crazy. I think that's the best thing to start at, because I think there's no way that you would take two then urban, raised in suburbia, graduate students who really knew nothing about agriculture and say, yeah, let's get a farm and let's trust you guys to have one. And they say that God protects children and idiots, and I think that that's pretty much how we got through. But we, you know, moved with my husband's grandparents to this farm and planted our first garden ever in the dirt. Before that, I'd had gardens up on balconies and in pots. And then the next year, we said, well, we grew more than we could eat, so maybe we should have a CSA. Maybe we should deliver subscriptions to other people. And so we took 7 clients and learned a lot really fast and added chickens and started bringing them eggs and baking bread and making flowers. And at our peak, we were delivering vegetables to 22 families, all done. We never owned a tractor. It's all done by hand labor. And then I started writing books, and I decided I could either write books or run a CSA, but not both. So the CSA went by the wayside, and my family is now, we raise pasture poultry for meat, we raise eggs, medicinal herbs, we also raise dairy goats, and a bunch of other farm projects. And we've been working on this sort of question of, what's our land best suited to? How can we use our steep, wet, rocky land in New York as best as possible and without doing damage to the wildlife habitat and while preserving as much of it as woods and as open space as possible?
When I talked with Severn von Scharner Fleming of the Greenhorns Movement, she spent the summers farming and the winters organizing. Are you finding yourself involved with the developing movement? And if so, does it have a name?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it has a bunch of names. I mean, what's sort of funny is I'm involved with a lot of movements. I have overlap with the permaculturists, with transition. I've run into the greenhorns over the years and the woofers, the willing workers on organic farms. I consider myself, if I had to pick an identity, I'd call myself an agrarian, but a modern agrarian, one who thinks that agrarian things happen in cities and suburbs as well as in the country. So what's really fascinating to me is that there's a lot of movements, and they're movements that really cross political lines, they cross social lines. I find myself speaking to groups of, I'm a leftist Jew, and I find myself speaking about these issues to groups of conservative evangelical Christians and to business groups that are concerned with food services and making sure that food prices are stable. It's really fascinating to me the degree to which this food question really unites people and gets people talking who don't talk to each other all that often. So I guess I would say that I'm part of a lot of movements.
And I've been reading your blog for over a year now. It's got some terrific stuff. I often see it reprinted all over the net in places like the Energy Bulletin and the Oil Drum and Grist or Hen and Harvest. But you seem to have sort of switched blogs. And so can you give us your latest blog address where listeners can find you?
Yeah, I blog in two places. My farm blog is www.sharonastick.com, and Astick is A-S-T-Y-K. And I also recently switched over to Science Blogs, which is the largest technology and science blogging site on the net, actually. So I also blog at www.scienceblogs.com/Casaubon's book. And Casaubon is C-A-S-A-U-B-O-N. And it's all one word, Casaubon's book.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Sharon Astick. She's a subsistence farmer, writer, and activist in New England. Sharon, thank you for doing all that you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.